Opinions expressed on ACB Radio are those of the respective program contributors and cannot be assumed to serve as endorsements of products or views of the American Council of the Blind, its elected officials, or its staff.
Hello, hello, and welcome everybody to day two of the California Council of the Blind's virtual conference and convention. Our theme this year is Navigating the Future Together. I just want to take 2 seconds here to remind everyone that we do have our virtual exhibit hall open right now as of 9 a.m. I will be sending that out to the list again today, this morning, but if you are not on any of the CCB list and would like to visit, you can email me at convention.ccb@gmail.com, and I will shoot that right on over to you. Again, that's convention.ccb@gmail.com. And I am Sarah Harris, First Vice President of the CCB. And this morning we are joined by Steve Mendelson from the North and Pam Metz from the South, and they are here to give us a wonderful presentation about healthcare advocacy, navigating healthcare in the dark. So many of us, we go to the doctor, we're, you know, with a family member, the doctor's talking to our family member, not us, you know, we're trying to make appointments and the website isn't working. And they're going to talk to us about some different scenarios that have happened in their lives or the lives of others and what have happened to, you know, be a resolution in that. So I'm going to go ahead and hand it all on over to Steve and Pam.
Thank you very much, Sarah, and good morning, everyone. Thank you all for being here. We're going to try to do something a little bit unique today. We're going to have a dialogue which combines some of Pam's personal experiences, situations she encountered along the lines that Sarah described and others, and how she dealt with them from an advocacy point of view. And then I'm going to add in what might be the legal perspective surrounding each of these situations. We're going to talk about three situations that Pam has encountered in her life that she's dealt with and that she's generous enough to share with us today. And then if time permits, we're going to engage you and the audience in some dialogue. So with that in mind, Pam, good morning, and why don't you start?
Good morning, everybody. This is Pam, and hello. First off, the first scenario is very interesting. I lost my sight 20 years ago. It's been since June of 2000, and so that's 21 years ago. I have a very rare optic autoimmune deficiency that attacks my eyes, but they didn't know this at the time. They just were trying to protect the blindness. I was working at the time and had already lost the sight of my right eye and had gone to the doctor because I was losing driving home, realized I couldn't barely see, went to the emergency room. They gave me an eye drop, which caused it. They had given me an eye drop that caused it. The headache to get worse. The next thing I knew, I couldn't see. Went to the doctor, was told, well, you need to get a spinal tap. We need a spinal tap so we can find out what's going on with your eyes. Went home, laid on the bed, was thinking about, okay, I'll just wait until they call me so they can do this spinal tap. And they're going to schedule it for the next week or two. And so this happened on June 19th when I lost all the sight. It was June 19th when I lost all the sight, 2000. So when I, a little while later, a couple hours later, I got a call from Kaiser. I was under Kaiser medical care at that time. And so I got a call, and I was living in Orange County at the time.
Audio output volume.
And I was told that we have an appointment on September 16th.
Volume up.
Oh, really? September? She said, I said, don't you have anything sooner? This is very serious. She said, no, we can fit you in September, accept that appointment or not. So I took the appointment and I thought about it and I said, let me call my own doctor who was a Kaiser doctor. And so I said, and let me call a patient advocate. So I called my own doctor and I explained to her what's going on. And then I called a patient advocate and explained to them what was going on. And within a couple of hours, I got a call back from both stating that your appointment is going to be the next day. And can you get a ride to Kaiser or Yorba Linda to do the spinal tap? And I said, sure. But it took me calling the Kaiser physician, my doctor, I even remember her name, and the patient advocate to get this moved forward. Otherwise, I would have had to wait until September 16th, and that wouldn't have done me any good because it would have gotten worse, and the headaches were bad already, and they couldn't figure out why I was losing the sight, so they wanted me to wait until September 16th. It didn't make sense, so I called both the doctor and the patient advocate and had the appointment the next day. That's it, Steve.
Well, that's a great story, Pam, and I really appreciate the advocacy skills and tenacity that you showed there. I think if they'd called me and said September 16th, I would have asked what year. In any event, what you did was utilize the resources at your disposal, and resources which, in theory, ought to bring about some results. It's very important, particularly in managed care systems, to have a doctor who's willing to go to bat for you. In terms of scheduling or in terms of what tests are ordered and things of that nature. And it's also very important to have a patient advocate who will go to bat for you as well. Sometimes we are lucky in that regard. Sometimes we are not. It's sort of the luck of the draw. You can't tell. From a legal standpoint, the aspects of this that intrigue me are as follows. Number one, I think that in the case of a rare condition such as yours, it might easily have been the case that you needed to go to a number of specialists to be properly diagnosed, let alone treated. It sounds like you were fortunate in getting a diagnosis reasonably quickly, but often with something rare and uncommon, such as your condition was, that's not the case. So the question then becomes, under our insurance systems, what rights do we have to a second opinion, or in the case of a network like Kaiser, to go out of network? And that's basically pretty complicated, but broadly speaking, if you can't be treated for your diagnosis that you have, or can't be properly diagnosed, or have a history of dealing with a particular specialist or kind of specialist, you have, and again, I'm speaking very broadly here, a right to insist on being allowed to go out of network. Sometimes you may even be able to get some assistance in finding a suitable out of network practitioner, but you have a right that under most of the managed care systems that are in place, and it would certainly be the case under Medicare as well, to insist on being allowed to go out of network and have the non-network physician reimbursed at the applicable rate that would apply if you were in network. Again, negotiating these is almost often more the issue than establishing the legal right. In many of these situations, the real determinant, as you have demonstrated already, and may be described as one's social skills and one's bureaucratic skills, and maybe to a certain degree, one's medical knowledge. And in your case, you had enough knowledge to know that the procedure couldn't wait. But it's these soft skills which sort of split the difference between law and social interaction with a bit of medical knowledge sprinkled in that really determine the outcome in all too many cases. I could cite the laws that apply, but until you got them activated in the face of resistance, it would be a long time and probably, as a practical matter, too late. But you did it. And that's great.
Thanks,
so,
Steve.
You want to tell us about another one?
Yeah, the second one is happened in 2008 when I decided to have weight loss surgery, and we had moved out to Ken and I had moved out here to the Valley, and I was going to Kaiser Woodland Hills, and I told him and I decided to do the weight loss program. And I told him that I needed the paperwork, the information, the log, the ability to read all their stuff in an accessible format, just like everybody else in the class. And I've been involved with CCB at that point for a while. So I knew that I should be able to get everything I needed in an accessible format to be able to either plug it into the computer or to have it in Braille or some other format that would make it easier for me to follow along with the rest of the class in doing this bariatric program to have the surgery. Well, I was told, well, we can't get that for you. We don't know how to do it. They had many, 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 many excuses. But I broke it down. I talked to Ken. I talked to other people about this. And I thought about it. And I said, well, look, I don't need people sitting here reading me these questions. And then I have to tell them my personal insights of personal business. That's not fair. Nobody else in the class has to do this. So I talked to the instructor again and the person who was running the program. And she says, well, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to tell you. And I said, so, okay. I said, so this, so I'll have to take it above your head. So I took it. Ken told me who to contact. I said, okay, I'll handle it. I don't need you to handle it. I'll handle it. So I contacted my patient advocate. I contacted member services, and member services said yes. In your profile, you should be able to get everything you need in accessible format. And my patient advocate said the same thing. You should be able to get. We will make sure you do. They kind of sort of did. They got me a CD that did not work at all. They just threw everything on the CD, pictures and all, graphics and all, and I could not manage that CD to save my life. I gave it to Ken. He could not manage it to save his life because you could not get above those graphics. I reported it again. We went to a young lady who handles the whole area, the whole southern region. I forgot her name, but she's a patient, a person who handles the southern region of Kaiser. And I spoke with her, and she said, okay, we will make sure we get this done properly. It took them, the program was 12 weeks. I got the CD in a corrected format where I can actually write myself notes and put them in the CD, in there, print out the page, I could copy it, put it on my computer, and then answer the questions, and then print it out and take it to class. I got this CD. Now, understand, the program was 12 weeks long. I got this CD week 11. And I did as much as I could. I was approved for the surgery and everything. But it took them from before I started actually started the program, to week 11 to get me the CD in a format that I could literally use, make a copy of the page, put it on my computer, answer the questions, and then print it out and take it to class. But it took them that long to get it in a format that I could at least handle on the computer. When I got this done, they were, oh, we're sorry, but it's okay. And that's it, Steve. I finally got it, but it took 11 weeks to get it.
Wow. I'd say better late than never. Clearly, you and Ken made a very formidable advocacy team. And I doubt if anybody could have gotten it more quickly. Still, that's very frustrating and very wrong. So what are the legal issues that this story suggests to us? Number one, the first problem is that for something like a CD, which is routinely handed out to a lot of people who take a particular course or enter upon a particular line of treatment, that should be available in accessible form to start with. They shouldn't have to do it on a one-off basis when somebody makes a request. It ought to be there. It's not as if they don't have printed copies available to send out to people who sign up for the course. So that's problem number one. And the way one would deal with that legally would be to see if they have a procedure or a policy in covering the matter, and if not, to try to get them to institute one. And ultimately, if it's serious enough, and they won't institute one, or if they institute one but refuse to actually comply with it, then to seek legal redress. And I won't go into the various means of doing that right now, but there are ways one could try to do that, again, bearing in mind that it's going to be a lengthy process at best. Broadly speaking, also, you're talking about access to information, electronic or print or otherwise, both unilaterally in the sense of information that just comes to you as a patient, and also interactively, in terms of information that you have to give to someone else, into the system, so to speak. So what are the issues that are raised here? Well, the first issue here is we're not talking about documents in and of themselves for their own sake. The documents matter because they tell you what preparations you have to make. They tell you if there are any contraindications, who should or who should not get the procedure, perhaps. They tell you about the prep that you may have to do, if any. They tell you about what you have to do during the course or say in preparation for a procedure. And so those are all issues of pretty straightforward accessibility. Oddly enough, some of the early landmark cases under the ADA involved access to healthcare. And those cases, including a very famous Supreme Court case, made it very clear that people with disabilities have a right to treatment. They can't be turned away because of their disabilities. Fine. But as you found out here, that doesn't say much about what the quality or timeliness of that treatment will be. And those are stickier, more difficult and more elusive problems to get hold of. The next issue, of course, which you also allude to, is privacy. In theory, we all have a right to privacy in the medical system. There is a statute called HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which you all know about, because whenever you go to a doctor or fill out a form, you get warned or have to consent to agree to your knowledge of the HIPAA provisions. Well, again, I would argue, and this has never been litigated yet, I'm hoping it will be if the opportunity comes up, and I hope it will. I believe where forms are inaccessible or when one is required to give information verbally to someone not of one's choice, and someone who would not normally be authorized to receive such information, or one has to reach out for help from a third party, often even a stranger, as you sometimes do, for example, in the case of the kiosks, which give you admittance to healthcare facilities. We'll be hearing about kiosks in the next hour. In those cases, I would argue that your right to privacy is being forcibly violated, that you're being forced to waive your right to privacy against your will. And I believe there is a possibility for administrative complaints under HIPAA to the Department of Health and Human Services, to CMS, but I'm not aware that route has been followed very often yet. I'm hoping that it will be if the occasion arises, sadly enough. Again, I commend you for your perseverance and for your ultimate success. And those are some of the legal issues. So why don't we go on? I'm going to suggest, if you agree, Pam, that we do your third and final scenario now, and then take questions from the audience members on whichever one or ones of the scenarios they want to talk about further.
That's fine. The last scenario has to do with Ken when he was in the hospital, and all of you know he was in the hospital for 23 days between Kaiser Sunset, which is in Los Angeles, and Kaiser Woodland Hills, which is in the San Fernando Valley. We had discussed his do not resuscitate orders, do not resuscitate as a DNR. We had discussed that, and it was in his advance directive, and when we had already filled that out. And He developed MRSA, and he had a terrible infection, and we knew he knew it, and he ended up in the hospital having strokes and stuff like that. Well, he had gone to, the doctors wanted him to go to Kaiser Sunset, which is in Los Angeles, to see if they could repair his heart valve, because the MRSA was growing all over the heart valve, and they were trying to get the MRSA under control. And the doctors talked to me before they sent him over there. And I said, did you talk to him? Because he is alert. Well, you know, he's blind. I said, so am I. So talk to him. So they talked to him and he said, fine. And I said, okay, they asked me, does he have a DNR? I said, yes, he does. And he said the same thing. Yes, I do. So when we went to Sunset, they did all the tests and found out that he did have a bad spell where he almost died because of one of the antibiotics trying to kill the MRSA. And they took him off of it, and they decided to put him on palliative care, which means it's basically hospice care. In the hospital, they called it palliative care. And I had no problem with that. In the meantime, I called his daughter and got in touch with his daughter. Oh, what an experience that was. But when he was at Sunset, I asked him, do you want to go to Woodland Hills? It's closer to home. And he said, I want to go home to I want to go back to Kaiser Woodland Hills. I said, okay. And his daughter said, no, don't move him. I said, it's up to your father. He can make his own decision. And so we moved him back to Woodland Hills, and his family fought me tooth and nail about his do not resuscitate order. They said it was falsified, blah, and everything. And then we had to call his case manager. We had to call the hospital's hospitalist. We had to call the patient advocate. And I had to call one of, when they called down one of the med- I think it was administrator or something like that, they called down to discuss this with the family, because the family was yelling at me and calling me all kinds of names and stuff like this. But Ken and I had already discussed this, and it was in his advance directive what he wanted done. And they were accusing me of trying to kill him and things like this. And so the social worker and the, if I hadn't called his social worker, the hospitalist and the patient advocate, and the social worker had his advance directive with her and read it to the family. If we hadn't had that already done, I don't know what they would have tried to do to keep Ken alive. I'd have no idea what that his family would have done. But we had already taken care of that. So I had to literally deal with his family when Ken was dying. And it was, and things like that happen. It happens in pretty much every family. But Ken and I took care of this long before he got sick. And an advance directive is very important, very, very important to all of us. You need to make sure it's done. But I had to call the social worker and the hospitalist and the patient advocate to back the family off of me, because if I hadn't have done that, they would have, I don't know what they would have done to try to keep him breathing. But they found out there was nothing they can do. He did have a do not resuscitate order that was posted on his door, and he died very peacefully. And Franklin, that's my guide dog, and I were both there. But it took me a fight to get his family to understand that yes, he does have a DNR. No, I'm not trying to hurt your father. No, I'm not trying to hurt your brother. And I called all these people, and if I hadn't called them, I don't know what they would have done. And this hurts my heart every time I think about it, because he was precious to me. So. Yeah, if I hadn't called his social worker, and she came over and gave me a hug, she said, if you guys hadn't have done this, we don't know what would have happened. He could have done it. He could have filled one out when he went into the hospital, but we had already taken care of it. And I had to push Ken to get this done. It took me a minute to get him. Come on, you got to get this done. Get this done. Get this done. So it's done. And he was hard-headed about it. I don't want to do it right now. But he got it done, and it took us a minute to do it. And the patient advocate was wonderful. She talked with the family. She pulled them to the side between her and them and the social worker. And then the hospitalist explained to them that with the MRSA, it was basically killing all his organs. He's not going to survive this. They had to put it very bluntly to them. I knew this, spending a lot of years working with in the hospitals, but they needed to understand that. And that's what happened to him and us when he was in the hospital.
Thank you, Pam. What a painful situation, and we're really grateful for you sharing it with us. We know what a difficult time it was and what a painful memory it must be. What strikes me about this from the legal standpoint is, and once again, you hit the nail right on the head, it's the importance of planning, of preparation. And that means two things. It means, number one, thinking through what you want to do, and number two, making sure to have the documents that reflect that. There's always, in the legal world, a distinction between truth and proof, as I like to say. Something can be true, it can be somebody's intention, it can be somebody's wishes, but if there isn't the necessary documentary proof, all kinds of problems can arise. And these problems you've described, again, very aptly, what happens with families, where there's disagreement about what to do, and where some people don't want to let go, and other people recognize the futility of imposing further suffering. And that causes problems, but it's even more likely to cause problems where a disability is involved, because the medical system, frankly, and this is something which can manifest itself in legal situations, but which is ultimately more attitudinal than anything else. The medical system does not distinguish disability from illness. And that's really the fundamental problem that I think many of us, particularly people who are undergoing hospital care or acute treatment, face. I can remember myself being in the hospital for a couple of days several years ago with a gastrointestinal problem, and they insisted on putting up rails around my bed. And I said, why? I'm not a railroad train. And they said, no, you might fall out of bed. I said, well, that's ridiculous. Why am I any more likely to fall out of bed than anyone else? You don't put rails up around everybody, do you? No, we don't. Then why me? Well, that's our rules. We have to. And the point here is that the question is, what is the law? And very often, as a practical matter, the law is the rules and policies and procedures of the entity or agency or institution you're dealing with. There's a concept called the law of the case. And I won't go into it in greater detail than to say there are certain cases where some features of a case will determine what the law applicable to it is. And in many cases with hospitals or doctors, the law of the case is the procedures that the institution uses. And from their standpoint, that is the law. And from the standpoint of their employees, that is the law too, because if a person feels they're going to get in trouble, and there is a real fear of getting in trouble, of being deemed negligent and so on and so forth, and that fear makes it so easy to overreact and be ludicrously overprotective. If you're afraid that you're going to be disciplined or punished administratively by your boss, by your employer, for respecting somebody's rights, then you're not going to do it because your self-interest is at stake. And because, very frankly, it can't matter much to you what the law is in the world at large if the law in your workplace is different. And so that's a problem we always have to face. And what we have to do there is whenever we encounter a situation where an institutional policy or practice or regulation is adverse to fairness, adverse to justice, or let alone in violation of law, what we need to do in those cases, again, is to find out how to lobby the organization, often at the highest level, to change it. And that's a long and slow process. I would say it's about equivalent to the melting of glaciers, except glaciers are melting pretty quickly these days, so maybe we have a better chance. So I want to thank you, Pam, very much for sharing those memories with us and for each of these stories and for your advocacy skills and your successes and your perseverance in all these cases. I think maybe now we do want to throw it open to our audience and our fellow members and discuss what's going on. And I apologize for that beeping in the background. It's some device of mine which will be stopped beeping in a minute or so, so I do apologize. But anyway, let's see who has to talk to us.
So we currently have three raised hands, and ending in 115, I have given you permission to talk.
I think you're talking to me.
I think
Hello,
I
Roger.
Am, yes.
Yes, it's Roger. All right, I have a couple of things. One, I raised my hand actually before the panel started because I had a point of privilege before the program item started, and that's still relevant, I think. And that is that I wanted to say to the person who is chairing the meeting that I understand we have a terrible fire going on in Orange County, and I suggest that the chair express the concern of the organization to our Orange County friends. But also related to the subject here, I have found that the hospitals and doctors tell me that because I'm blind, I must have a bracelet that says falling risk on my wrist. And, I'm a little concerned about this because I think that maybe I am becoming a falling risk. I'm 80 years old now, and I have some issues that might possibly make me a falling risk. But I've been in the same situation with the rails up around my bed and all that when there was no reason to have them. And I think that's a really important point to make. And thank you. I'm done.
Thank you, Roger. As usual, you raise two important points here. Number one, you corroborate, as I'm sure many others of us could, the widespread use of these restraints based on these stereotypes. But you raise another issue, too, which is one of intersectionality. What happens when stereotypes about blindness combine with stereotypes about age? And what happens further when we ourselves as individuals don't know if maybe in this case the seemingly overprotective measure might not actually be justified, as you say. We always have the right not to object, of course, you exercise that right, I suspect. And if that made you feel more comfortable, that's fine. But if you wanted to object, I wanted to parse what was disability related and what was age related. I would have asked the question, well, if I were 20 years younger, would you be having me wear this bracelet? If the answer is yes, then you have a pretty straightforward blindness issue. If the answer is no, then you have a more complex issue because age has entered into it as well. But thank you for that illustration.
All right, we are just past the 30-minute mark, past the hour, and Debbie Kessler, you are next.
Okay. Hi, all. Wow. When I started out, when I raised my hand, I had 1 point, and now I have five. But I'll only talk about one. The way this has turned out and gone raises a lot of good issues. One is there is a whole group of blind people as in the baby boomer age that were born blind. And so now, like, I'm 70. And so my issues are more being old than blind. But then, you know, most people, understandably, I guess, but are not looking at, they look at blindness as part of my being old. And so their approach is different. No, my issue is being older, not my blindness. I've dealt with that. And my daughter and I got talking, of course, about the thing about getting up out of bed in the hospital and going to the bathroom. Well, if I know where it's at, I would just get up and go. And she says, well, now, because my daughter just became
an alarm for the bed.
Okay. She says now they have alarms on the bed to go off if you get out of bed. And so I just told her, well, I just tell them I'm going to go to the bathroom, you know, whatever, I'm going. But the point is well taken about it's enforced that on the employees about fall risks. It's really, they're scared of patients falling and being responsible. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. That's a very important point. And you raised the fact, the distinction between the probably the majority of blind or seriously visually impaired patients who hospitals see are people who've lost their sight in later life. And probably their unconscious assumptions about blindness, whatever they are worsened or exacerbated by the belief that the person is somewhat newly blinded and probably doesn't know very well how to cope as a blind person. As you say, in your case, as in Rogers, the issue was not coping with blindness, which you've been doing very adequately. Thank you for 70 years, and you wouldn't have lived as long if you hadn't been doing it. But the issue was the effect upon of age. And I must admit, I find this in all kinds of situations, too, because I'm an older person myself. I was always, I hope, respectful of people who offered me help. And when I didn't need it, I tried to reject it in a civil and respectful manner. And for the most part, I hope that I did. But as I get older and older and older, I'm more and more willing to accept help that I wouldn't have needed or wouldn't have wanted before, just because I am a little less mobile. I am a little more feeble, frankly, than I was as a younger person. All of us face in our lives, as we deal with the medical system and as we deal with the world outside the medical system, all of us face these internal conflicts as to what we can do, what we should do, what we can't do, and our skill sets, our confidence levels and our circumstances change so dramatically throughout the course of life that it's always a changing picture and a moving target in terms of coming to terms with what we really need and what we can accept and let alone what we can do to resist if we don't want to accept.
And next is Robert Acosta. Robert?
Thank you very much, and I'll try to be brief if there's others here. First of all, I want to commend Steve for his legal advice and my dear friend Pam for pouring her heart out to us. That takes a lot of courage. If I may, though, I'd like to say some good things about Kaiser. I don't know if a lawyer gets into that at all, but it was 08 when Pam had her issues. I believe it. I went through the disc with the FAP program. We got it in a month, Pam. It got a little better, but I know what you're talking about. But now, because I think I protested through the charts, they give you Braille material for after visits, for visits, summary. They used to hand me a print sheet that went out the window, you know. Now I get it in Braille because you lobby, as Steve said, and I think he's absolutely correct. I want to talk a little bit about my heart valve issue. We went to do that. I was not happy that the consent form had to be read by my reader. They didn't provide it in an accessible format. What are you going to do? I signed. I needed it, or I might not be around here. But I must say, remember when they had rails around my bed, but they did around everybody in the heart area, in the ICU area, and all these places. So be cautious here. Don't just say they're doing it because I'm blind. I'll tell you another thing. The nurse said, when you go to the bathroom, I would like to take you. We don't want you to fall. We don't want you to lift anything. We don't want you. You're sick in there, but you have to make that judgment call. And I have had some blind friends who said, I'm ready to sue. I'm looking for a reason. And so I had rails. So if I'm if I'm a coward, that's what I did. I set it off a couple of times. I didn't mean to. But I want to talk about the power of the doctor. Well, first, when they read the instructions to go home, the nurse said, why am I doing this? I said, madam, I'm blind. There's no reader at home. You got to read it. She kept saying, why am I doing this? So I protested. And they wrote me, I don't know if they did, that said she received appropriate training. She reads everything that a blind person wants read. So that's all I know about it. I didn't go see the nurse again. Last thing, I had to have warfarin every day, if you know what that is, blood thinner. And they were sending a guy out due to my doctor. The doctors in Kaiser and other places have a lot of power. And he came, but then one day he said, that's it. It's over. I can't come anymore. Well, I call my doctor. And he was there the next couple of days when he had to be. So they came to my home because I didn't want to go to Woodland Hills. So I want to commend structured negotiation. Lainey Feingold and Megan and the lawyers negotiated with Kaiser as well. So yes, as with bad that Pam described, there's also good. Can they do better? Of course they can. Thank you very much.
Bob, I want to say something here. Hold on, Steve. I want to say something here for everybody. I have a lot of respect for Kaiser. Kaiser is the largest medical HMO medical service in the state of California. And I would not have gone back to Kaiser if I didn't respect Kaiser. I have a wonderful physician here in Woodland Hills who I call and she's been my physician since Ken and I moved out to the Valley for 12 years now. And she understands all my aches and pains and woes and woos and but you still need, the strongest thing we have is our mouth and our ability to advocate for ourselves and our ability to think. There were times when I went into the hospital for a kidney stone and I wanted to get up and go to the bathroom and they said, well, you can't walk by yourself. And I said, really? I can't. So I said, let's go. I need to go to the bathroom. Well, no, I got up and they took me to the bathroom and they had the alarm on. I said, you better turn the alarm on before I get out of this bed or it's going to go off. Well, how did you know it was on? I said, I'm blind and I'm laying in this bed. You guys think I can't walk by myself. You just said that. So yes, there are some problems. And yes, we have structured negotiation, but overall we have the medical system we have because we've all figured out a way to work within that system. And that's what we have to all figure out, a way to work within the system that we have.
Bob, thank you, Pam. Bob, a couple of things. Number one, I think that, again, you raise the question of the subtle and complex interaction between disability and illness, because although they're different, they sometimes occur together. Secondly, so far as my legal advice is concerned, I want to assure you that I charge no fee and you get what you pay for. Be that as it may, I think that you raise a number of good questions. And essentially, I think that we have to think about ways to get these institutions to have a little more flexibility and to recognize individuality. You hear more and more about patient-centered medicine. about individualizing treatment, things of that nature. And these are the more and more the watchwords of the people who set medical policy in this country. But they're not the watchwords of the day-to-day implementation of that policy or of the ways that individuals experiencing it experience it on a day-to-day level. And this involves problems that go far beyond our sphere of expertise or our experience and really go to fundamental problems with the medical system as it affects everyone. I see no particular solution to those problems. I just hope that we can make sure those problems are no worse for us than for anyone else.
All right, next we have Jordan.
Hi, I had a question. How can we lobby Loma Linda University to provide patient summaries in Braille?
Well, that's a good question. I had that problem, as I say, when I was hospitalized. Oh, and I want to also emphasize, by the way, that just in response to Bob's concern, no one is being critical of Kaiser here. We happen to have mentioned Kaiser because Pam's experience was with Kaiser, but Kaiser is used here only as an illustration. It would not be very different anywhere else, the good or the bad. It would be, in all likelihood, be about the same with any managed care system, and managed care is increasingly becoming the means through which medical care and medical services are provided. So I really want to emphasize that. There's no criticism intended of Kaiser at all. Jordan's question is a good one. And again, this goes back to procedures. If we are dealing with a hospital system or a medical care system, be it Kaiser or any of a number of others that we could name, the trick is to try to get in touch with them at the highest level, their ADA coordinator, perhaps, even the CEO, the general counsel, and to say, well, look, there are certain documents that you know you're going to be preparing for people on a regular basis. Everyone who is hospitalized receives discharge instructions when they leave. Everyone who is going to get a certain test receives preparation information when they're going to leave or in advance of doing the test. So you know that a certain kind of document is going to be provided for every person in a particular category. Why don't you take steps to make sure that that document is available in the variety of accessible forms that people need? If you know that you're going to have people with hearing impairments in your hospital, so you make arrangements either for captioners or for real-time captioning, or there are disputes over what kind of captioning works. But you certainly work on captioning, and you work on interpreters, ASL interpreters, either in person or via Zoom or otherwise. You know it's going to happen. You have to be prepared for it. Same thing here. The problem is there are so few of us, so it's probably the average hospital ADA coordinator, even the large system ADA coordinator, could work 20 years and get maybe 5 requests for Braille. So it's not going to be at the top of their to-do list. We have to make sure, therefore, that it gets done in advance of the individual request, whether the methods and procedures exist for getting it done quickly. And as you say, Bob, structured negotiation is an invaluable tool for getting that kind of thing done. You mentioned the invaluable work that was done by Lainey and her colleagues and other members of our wonderful legal community with Kaiser. Interestingly enough, though, an issue that I've been concerned about, and it occurs not only in healthcare but otherwise, is what happens when the settlement agreements lapse? These settlement agreements, I think the one for Kaiser, I'm guessing it was for 3 years, maybe it was for 5, maybe it was for 2.5. They're typically 3 years, though. And what happens when they lapse? What can we do to assure that there's continuity, that there's follow through? What kind of institutional memory do these organizations have? What kind of systems change has occurred and has become embedded in the organization's collective DNA, so to speak, during the period of time that the settlement agreement was in effect? We're facing these issues now, not only in healthcare, but in employment, in education especially, and in every other sector where these settlement agreements have done so well for us in terms of accessibility, but they always run out. And law by contract, is an inherently unstable thing.
All right, next we have Alan.
I had a procedure done 4 years ago, and the documents was in the PDF, getting back to documents.
Uh-huh. Well, there again, now the issue you're raising is, I guess, who's responsible for converting the PDF into an accessible format? Depending on what computer skills you have, you could do it, or if you don't have the skills or the technology, then maybe you couldn't. But the question is, it shouldn't really, I think, have to be your responsibility any more than it would be the responsibility of a person who speaks only language A to find some way to translate a document that they received in language B. I think that it should not be a problem. Now, the interesting point is this. Institutions do not want to convert materials out of PDF because they're afraid that once they get converted, they'll be changed. Yes. And the advantage to them of PDF is there's no possibility of the document being changed or altered in ways which they don't want or which could raise questions as to what they actually said. So that's a complexity. But as I say, it's something you can do or have someone you trust do for you.
I'm sorry to interrupt. The reason why I asked because I was able to read the documents myself because I have a computer. But my brother does not use a computer, and that's why I'm raising the question, though.
Right. Well, and that question is perfectly clear. Now, here we have the problem. Nowadays, most medical information that we share with our practitioners, our providers, whether they share with us, goes via these portals, these health records portals. And they're inaccessible in many cases. That's a problem for technology users. But as you say, for a non-technology user, the inaccessibility is almost beside the point. Doesn't matter if it's accessible or not. If I have a computer, it's like saying it's too bad the subways are slow. It doesn't really matter to me because I live in an era where there's no subways. That's a problem. And in a case like that, I think you have to ask generally, what do you do for people who do not have computers? What provision do you have for making documents, information that they contain, accessible and available to people who don't have any means of gaining access to your portal? And that's a broader question. The secondary question, if they have none, then you have to think about, again, try to get them to develop a procedure because a lot of their patients are going to be not necessarily technology users, particularly older people or people who are poor who don't have access to the internet because they live in areas that don't have the coverage or because they can't afford the fees, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a broader question. The subsidiary question is, once they establish some policy for making documents available to people who don't have technology, then the question becomes, what do you do about accessibility? Because you're obviously not going to just give me a print document and tell me I'm on my own to read it. You wouldn't do that for other people. As I said, you wouldn't do it in a language context. Why would you do it in the disability context?
All right, and our final raised hand for the moment, Deb, once again.
Okay, so my question is then in terms of the what was decided legally and what information's provided per the clients. Is it broad enough to cover when there are changes in technology that happen rather quickly for places like Kaiser to update what they have available to provide adequate services? Because language you always, usually speak the same language in that. But PDFs now is the thing. But the things like Kaiser has gone from the tags, ScriptTalk. Now they have ScriptTalk. And I've run into some pharmacies where they say, well, it'll take us a week before the person who works the machine to make the labels for you to provide that label. And where that's exactly what I told them. And the other pharmacies, I've had them see me in line. And the person who does that, I mean, because they don't have everybody do it. I understand that. But the person, they're always there. They always say hi to me by name before I even show up on the register that I'm going to pick up a prescription. So go ahead. Yes.
Go for it, Pam.
Do that, right?
Okay. Okay, I'm sorry, but I was like, no. Because every
from what I understand, talking to the pharmacist at the Porter Ranch Kaiser, every pharmacist has to know how to use and make the script talk labels. Every pharmacist.
Because
the main pharmacist, every pharmacist who works in that pharmacy has to know how to use script talk and make the labels for you. Because they, from what I understand at the Porter Ranch Pharmacy, when I, because I had a problem, one of the pharmacists was at lunch, the main one was at lunch, and he, the other one was like, well, I don't know how to do it. And I said, really? Yeah. Well, I need this medication on the script talk label. Well, I don't know if I can do it. And when she came back and I told her what was said, because I wouldn't accept the medication and I would not leave. And she said, oh, no. We need to teach you how to use it because every pharmacist in this building needs to know how to use script talk. And she, when I talked to her again, because understand, I, these pharmacists I knew at the other pharmacy that closed, and they just opened this facility a couple of years ago. And so what I'm understanding is what she told me is she said every Kaiser pharmacist in the southern region, because they don't know what goes on in the north, but they do know what goes on down here, has to know how to make a script talk label. And that in the, to say, no, we don't know how, or we don't have anybody to do it, it's going to take a week, is unacceptable. They need to do it that day and when you request it. And if you need it on the same medication every time, if the doctor changes it, who's to say the doctor has not changed your prescription? They need to do it. And every pharmacist, from what I understand, every pharmacist needs to know how to use the machine to do script talk labels.
Very good. It was the same prescription twice that they did this to me. And when I told them, when I had put my order in a week in advance anyway, and when it I went to pick it up, and they said it was going to be a week for the label, I says, well, I'm going to go above. I'm going to have to talk to somebody else in regards to this. And they called me an hour later that afternoon to say that my prescription was ready. And I asked them right then, I said, does that include the label? I didn't want to walk over there and have to walk a mile and then have to and walk home without my prescription. So they took care of it, but that's good. That's better than what I expected from them in terms of, I just figured, hey, if they have one person that's there, that there's always somebody there to do it, that would have been fine by me too. So good news. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We are 52 minutes past the hour, and Frank, you are next.
Hang on. I just want to add to what Pam has already said. Actually, I want to say that if I ever need an advocate, I'm going to retain Pam to the job. Deborah, you raise an interesting point. When we get health care, it's always provided not by one person, but by dozens of people. Just think of any sequence from office appointment to meeting with the doctor to prescription filling to getting to and from the pharmacy if need be, to getting to and from tests if need be, to prepping for the tests. The number of people involved can be legion. And if that system breaks down anywhere along the way, if one person is recalcitrant or doesn't know what they're doing or doesn't understand or is out to lunch, literally or figuratively, if that system breaks down, the whole chain, it's like a supply chain. We've been hearing so much lately about the reason for inflation is because supply chains are disrupted. Well, this is a services supply chain. And if it gets broken or slowed to a point, it can have all kinds of ramifications. The law can only address that broadly speaking, again, in terms of basic fundamental principles that organizations have to adhere to. But when it comes to dealing with an individual who is not complying with procedures or not acting responsibly or sensibly, it does usually come down to a case of individual advocacy.
All right, Frank, you are up.
Yeah,
and
quickly.
This is Sarah, real quick. Frank, you're going to be our last question, and then we need to go ahead and wrap up Pam and Steve. Go for it, Frank. Sorry.
Okay, a quick suggestion, since getting documents in accessible formats is really important, is that there's some things that we can do before we get sick in that regard. First off, I would encourage each of us to reach out to your blindness service provider to get you in touch with a competent producer of accessible documents, whether that's a Braille transcriber or somebody who can get PDF documents into accessible formats. And then what I would encourage you to do is to get that document person connected up with the appropriate people, say your ADA coordinator at your health provider, so that they actually have a resource that they can turn to get documents produced in accessible format, so that then when you ask for those things, your healthcare providers have a resource to turn to get that done.
Frank, that's very good advice. I just want to mention that's one respect in which HIPAA sometimes works against us. I've heard of cases where a person was identified, for example, as a Braille transcriber or as a renderer of large print, but the healthcare organization refused to deal with them because they weren't authorized medical personnel within the meaning of HIPAA. So sometimes they're going to demand of you, and you may even offer up front, a waiver to allow the documents to be shared with that person who you've identified and who you've put them in touch with. So ask them if they're going to need a waiver for that, and if so, execute it in advance.
Okay, Sarah said we got to wrap it up. So all I want to say is this. When you're dealing with your medical care, whether you're dealing with yours or a spouse or a family member, remember that you have avenues you can go to if you're having a problem. Patient advocate, a social worker, member services, and it doesn't have to be, I'm not talking about just Kaiser, but I'm talking about any medical care, any medical services that you need. You can find a way to do it. You can call member services and they can tell you who you can contact. You can file complaints through member services or any other complaint system. But if you don't advocate for yourself, you are making a mistake. People need to learn to advocate for themselves. It's very important, because if you live by yourself, then who's going to take care of it for you? And since I do, I did. But it's important, and I just think you get better health care that way if you can. And understand this, I'm going to say this, and this is my favorite saying. Doctors, nurses, hospitalists, everybody puts their pants on the same way you do, one leg at a time. There's no need to be afraid of them. Even if they try to intimidate you, just talk to them like you would talk to anybody else and explain to them what you need done. And they will help you. I was in the medical field for 30 years before I went blind. It isn't just talk to them like you would talk to anyone else.
Well, my only takeaway is if you have a problem, call Pam. But seriously, thank you all very much for your questions and for your interest. Thank you, Deb, for facilitating. And Pam, it's been a great pleasure to work with you.
Thank you, Steve. It was with you, too.
And bye. Steve and Pam, I just have to thank you guys so much. And you know, Steve, what you said right there is really true, because Pam has helped me with my healthcare advocacy. So if you guys need help, reach out and, you know, let's all work together to empower each other to be great advocates. So thank you very much, guys.
And thank you, Sarah.
Oh, thank you, Steve. You guys are awesome.
Thank you, and now, Sarah. I have a computer guy coming in an hour, so I need to get off for a while. I'll see you at 11:30.
I will see you at 11:30.